Welcome to Tech IE, a program brought to you by the New Hampshire chapter of IEEE, the largest society of technical professionals in the world. More information related to this program can be found at ieenh.org/shows. If you have questions or comments to ask or provide input on future topics, please feel free to go to the website and put your comments in there, and we'll try and get back to them on a future show or in conjunction with this show. Today, we'll focus on what is at stake with the FBI challenge to Apple on cell phone encryption. We'll also look at related questions like, why should the residents and parents of Bedford or any other town in the world care? And finally, at the webpage, we will have pointers to tips and tools you can use to protect your family online. I'm Jim Isaac, President Emeritus of the IEEE Computer Society and past Vice President of the IEEE Society on Social Implications of Technology. We have two IEEE members with us here today to explore the pros and cons of Apple's position on privacy, as well as to provide insight on why your online privacy and security are important. Dr. Paul Carr is an IEEE Life Fellow. His BS and MS degrees are from MIT, and he has a PhD in physics from Brandeis. From 1967 to 1995, Paul led the component technology branch of the Air Force Research Laboratory in Bedford, Massachusetts. His branch's research on surface acoustic waves resulted in signal processing filters used in radar, cellular telephones, and television. He has published over 80 technical articles and has 10 patents. After his retirement from AFRL, he taught philosophy classes at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, which inspired his 2006 book, Beauty in Science and Spirit. In August 2014, he took part in an IEEE climate discussion produced by New TV, Newton, Massachusetts. A summary of this is available at Paul's website, http://mirrorofnature.org. Paul, welcome to Tech IE.
Thank you. Next. I might add, for those who don't know what IEEE means, it stands for Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers.
Thank you. Next, we have Anton Kaskas. Anton is a freelance consultant specializing in information security with a focus on international environments. In addition, Anton serves as the current chair of the IEEE Working Group P1915.1, Security in Virtualized Environments, which focuses on developing international security standards in areas such as network function virtualization and software-defined networks. Anton has previously developed and operated the North American Security Business Unit for Nokia Siemens Networks, where he provided formal input to U.S. government in areas of communications security for public safety networks, was a managing principal of a security professional services team in North America for Octel-Lucent. Prior to his work in North American security leadership roles, Mr. Kaskas served as the head of information security for Qatar Telecom, where he provided security leadership in Middle Eastern provider of mobile and fixed line voice services, and the national internet access provider. Before joining Qatar Telecom, Anton headed security services team with INS in Central Europe and also provided European-based security expertise to the U.S. government and NATO in Europe under contract to the Defense Information Systems Agency, the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command, the Army Research Laboratories, and Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Anton, welcome to Tech IE.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Recently, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies have pursued legal action against Apple to force them to break the encryption on iPhones so the information can be obtained related to terrorist attacks, drug dealing, and other criminal prosecutions. In Apple's recent devices, a combination of hardware and software is used to encrypt data, and an option exists to erase the data if more than 10 attempts are made to break into the phone. While two recent actions by the FBI were dropped when they found alternate ways to access the data, the basic issue has not been resolved in court. There's also legislation being proposed in Congress to require U.S. manufacturers of hardware and software to be able to provide access to data if ordered by the court to do so. Paul, you have asserted that Apple should take this required action in order to support the FBI. How do you see this?
Right. Well, if you remember the case as I remember it, basically, The FBI request was to unlock the phone used by this terrorist who killed something like 14 people out in the Los Angeles area. And when I first heard about it, I slightly favored the government, the FBI. But then when I learned that that the government had unlocked the phone with the aid of an undisclosed private party, I said to myself, I have an iPhone myself, and I said to myself, hey, wait a minute, I would trust Apple a lot more if they had unlocked the phone for the FBI, because this way they were in control and I would have confidence in them. But now I know that a third party was able to unlock their phone, so how do I know that they won't get into my phone at their will? I mean, and this brings up the issue. I recollect that when Barack Obama, before he was elected, he loved his BlackBerry, which was the equivalent of iPhone. But when he became president, his security people told him, you can't use it anymore, particularly for official business, because it's well known that a bad person or a foreign power with a powerful computer and smart programmers can always break into a simpler phone with not nearly as much processing. So that's basically why I. My argument, why I believe that Apple should have unlocked the phone, because I'd be more confident in them. But since then, I ran across an article that came out in this month's MIT Technology Review, and it says, "What if Apple is wrong?" And it says, "New layers of security on smartphones might damage the criminal justice system in return for only marginal gains in our personal privacy." That's sort of the summary. But in this article, they point out the basic problem, namely that it took a very sophisticated computer, a lot of processing power, for the FBI to break in. However, local police, municipal police, maybe even state police, don't have access to this very sophisticated technology, and therefore there are a number of crimes that one example they give, that it was the case of a person who was murdered, and he had the good sense to take a picture of the whole process. And a result of this was back before iPhones had the security they have today. The police were able to gain access to the phone, and they were able to prosecute the criminal. But that couldn't happen today. And the same article points out that that there are many cases like this of murders, child abuse, and so forth. This is the New York District Attorney, says that there's something like 215 cases that if they could get access to the iPhone, that they would be able to prosecute. But the cases are just that's pretty much my argument. That basically summarized again that for only a marginal increase in personal privacy, Some criminals are going free.
Okay. And just to point out that the article that you mentioned, Paul, will be pointed to from our website that I mentioned before.
That's right. This is available.
Anton, you've been concerned with the protecting of privacy for cell phone users. How do you see the situation?
I am, Jim. I share the concern of a lot of people that the police and law enforcement need access to devices and whatever holds data, whatever that might be. It might be your computer at home. It might be your cell phone. But I'm also extremely concerned about the privacy side of it. And the government, and especially local police departments, have historically, and by historic I mean as recent as yesterday, have an extremely poor record of protecting our privacy. They have a record of abusing it, and outside of the whole Snowden issue, there's repeated cases where the government, whatever that may be, whether it's the FBI or whomever, has overstepped their bounds and not followed the rules that they set up themselves. As far as the Apple-specific case goes, I just don't think that Apple should have been forced. However, I've got to add that I think it's just a business. It's a business position for Apple. Apple is known as being relatively secure device as opposed to a lot of others. And I think for them, it's more a business decision. Disconnecting from that, I feel extremely strongly about the privacy piece, and I don't think that the government should be able to force them to do this. They're never going to keep up with science. And the fact of the matter is they can legislate the laws all they want, but there will always be newer and better encryption. It may be that only the criminals have it, but there it will always be there, and people will always want to protect their privacy. It's one thing to, I mean, what we're seeing a lot of when the case was going on was a lot of pleading to the heart, if you will. Well, so-and-so will die if they don't get into that right now. And while I feel for that and I have empathy with that, the fact of the matter is that if Apple had have gone ahead and done something like that for the FBI and specifically developed a way to break into that and previous versions of that operating system, the U.S. government would not have been the only ones to have that. Let's be honest. They've already admitted the Chinese were into our government computers. If the FBI had that, then everybody else would have had that. Horrible regimes around the world. And is that fair? That's one of the, I mean, it's kind of letting the cat out of the bag. And it's already clawing out and only has its tail stuck in the bag as it is. I really believe we need to stick it back in and keep it there. I believe there's other ways that we should be able to develop to deal with this. We're not quite there cryptography-wise yet, but.
Okay. So, Paul, I noticed in Brazil that recently they shut down Facebook's WhatsApp for 2 days as a judicial objection to the increased security provided by that messaging system. We can anticipate that countries like Russia, China, and others might have different expectations for accessing encrypted data. Are there situations where you feel a supplier like Apple should be able to reject a request?
Well, I think if it's a foreign government, I think that's a little bit different than our own government. I think we should favor our own government over, obviously, we certainly wouldn't want the Chinese to have access to our security.
But one would assume that a government would apply the same rules in their own country. So if you want to operate in that country, you'd have to be prepared to concede to that government's processes.
Yeah. So, wouldn't argue with that.
Creates a quandary.
I think we see that currently in India. I believe India has some government regulations on devices so that they have to conform to their local rules. And while it's not our standard, it is theirs. And if you want to do business in some of those places, it's one of the things that technology companies have to look at and think about how they're going to address things like that.
Uh-huh. Anton, let me turn the situation around now, which is something that Paul alluded to, but I'll give you a specific case, which is that in Baton Rouge of Brittany Mills, who was murdered recently, and her diary was encrypted on her iPhone, presumably. So now we have a situation where we might be able to resolve a murder case if we could get access to that cell phone. Does that affect your perspective?
It doesn't. It pulls at my heart for sure, but it doesn't, because getting into Brittany's diary on her device, whatever it is, at the expense of every person on the planet using that device's privacy, I don't think is a good balance. I feel for the police in wanting to solve the case. I don't think that we should compromise the integrity of every single device with that run of the operating system or whatever it is, for that reason, and that it might be able to solve. We still don't know whether the device in the LA terrorist case even held anything. I would have thought that the FBI would have come out and touted it if it did, but they haven't said anything. So we don't even know if there was anything usable on that. I'm sure there most likely was, but we don't even know. It's all surmising things.
I would also expect that if the government did find something that led them to another terrorist cell or other terrorists, they might wait until they had completed their investigations and apprehension of those people before they released any insight on that. So
yeah, definitely. But there's other ways of getting a lot of that. I mean, communication is a two-way street, right? So I'm talking to you, Jim, and I'm talking to Paul. That's two two-way streets. So whatever I say isn't just located right here in my brain. It's also you're receiving it and you're receiving it.
And it's being broadcast in theory over the internet or through the waves, which allow another set of parties to listen in as well.
Exactly. Most communication is over the net today. So
Let me...
Well, I have a question, friend. Is it true that breaking into a single phone like this one person's phone would automatically expose everybody to...
Well, it wouldn't automatically expose them. However, the method that they would develop to do that, that basically, I believe they just burn a new, compile a new OS, basically, but that has a hole in it that they could use, they could exploit. For example, this timer where you try to log in three times and then it locks you out.
Right.
They would just remove that and then do a new version. If they could do that, bad people could figure out a way to do it as well. So that version, so let's say, I don't know what it was, version 8 or something.
Something.
So version 8 and everything before that, they're gone. So it would affect it. And in most cases, if you're going to do something like that, that would be the end result. I would be very, that's why I'm torn, because it's, but from a technology side, it's not going to fix it. If they forced Apple to do it, fine. But like me, we were talking earlier, on my cell phone, I have an encrypted voice application that runs separately, and I can say whatever I want, and nobody can hear it, right?
They can hear it, but they can't decrypt it.
And maybe they can decrypt it next year, but next year I'll probably have a different app that's even better, right? It's science. They're not going to, there's law, and there's science.
I think you're quoting Lester.
Lessig. They're not going to stop that. So we're going to keep driving forward, right? People are still going to want to get more mileage out of their car, and they're going to want to be able to do crazy things with their phone. And we're going to keep creating things to let them do that and answer those questions.
And the power of the cell phones are going to double over the next couple of years as well. So the ability to actually build those applications has increased over time.
Exactly. I just hope the batteries keep up.
By the way, that's one of IEEE's area of expertise. let me just point out to listeners that a variation on this situation is one that parents face, or perhaps should face, with their children's use of online devices. If the FBI has trouble getting to encrypted data, how can a parent monitor their children's online activities? To put this in context, I would encourage listeners to go to view the Bedford television show, Social Media, A Predator's Playground, that outlines the risk our children face from having online activity. A pointer to this will also be on ieenh.org/shows, the website, where you can find that link to the Bedford show. So it raises a question from what you said, Paul. Is it possible that people are going to be able to build a cell phone or a device that it basically cannot be decrypted either by the power of advanced technology or by the manufacturer themselves?
I think yes. The short answer is yes, and we're there. The NSA leaks and releases showed us that when technology stood in the way, what did the intelligence services, and not to pick on the NSA, there's some really brilliant minds there, but them and other intelligence organizations, what do they do? What are all those tools that were exposed do? They bypass the system. They look for somebody that implemented cryptography the incorrect way, and they exploit that to get in. They social engineer them. They break into the router on the network along the network path, and they put in listening devices there. They compromise the BIOS, the core operating system of network devices, radio cell towers, and things like that. They go after other targets when the technology challenge is too hard for them, too tough, when we develop something that at the moment they can't get into. They go around it, which is it's the same thing criminals will do, right? So it's just, thankfully, the intelligence agencies have a lot more resources than the criminals in most cases. So that's a good thing for society, whether it's here or anywhere in the world.
You used a term I just want to have you clarify for us, which is social engineering. Can you give us an idea of what that means?
Yeah, sure. So that's getting a person to do what you want them to do. Even though they know they really shouldn't be doing it, it's, you know, you're basically faking like you're somebody else, right? I'll say I'm so-and-so. Are you sure? Yeah. Or I need to reset my password. Is it really you? You're calling the bank or your credit card person. I don't know how many times I've caught, good, I'm at an advantage. I work in the security field, but I've called because me, the technology security guy, has locked himself out of his online credit card account again, you know, and forgot all my security questions because I chose such arcane questions, even I don't remember the answers to them. And so I call them up and I have to get back into my system. How do I get into my system? Well, they have to reset my password. To do that, they have to validate it's really me. So give me your address, give me your date of birth, give me your social security number, all the usual things that we can find on the internet anyway. And then they ask me something else. And if I just tell them over and over enough times that I don't remember or return, is the return key the one next to the control key or is it on the other side of the keyboard? Frustrate them enough that way, they'll finally give up. I don't care who they are. They will finally give up and they'll give in and do something they shouldn't do. A lot of times when we tested large corporations and really had a tough time getting in to their networks, we just seed the parking lot of the executive parking area with large gigabyte-sized USB memory sticks because it's free if it's laying on the yellow line in the parking area. And it doesn't matter if it's the chief financial officer that pulls up. He's going to bend over and pick it up, and he's going to stick it in a computer as soon as he gets in his office. He's a human. He can't help it.
I understand the rumors indicate that the Stuxnet virus that took out the Iranian centrifuges.
Right.
Might have been inserted into their systems by exactly that technique, leaving around a USB stick on a table in a coffee shop nearby the facility.
Judging from what we as normal people can hear about, that was a closed network, so there was air gaps, there was nothing, the network wasn't connected to anything, so you had to use some other memory device to introduce the virus, or unless you used a sound-based attack.
Yeah, I'll give one other example, since we've touched on another institution here of some interest called MIT. I was there a couple weekends ago, and I noticed on every door they have a notice that basically says, do not let other people in behind you. And that's a social engineering issue, because if you're opening doors that are otherwise locked and not accessible, and you're authorized to go through it, if you let the person behind you go through, you now may have let somebody into the building who shouldn't have gotten in there.
Yeah, we call that tailgating in the security trade.
Right. I've seen it.
It's an easy way to get into a really secure building where they spend a lot of money on their doors and guards.
Right. No, I've seen it done in other contexts as well. I've done it myself at times. Perfectly legal, but nevertheless, people are always kind, and they're trying to get the students at MIT to take awareness that kindness may not be well-founded as a security concern.
Yeah, we use that often to get in, even multiple people. If you have a multi-member team, the person doing the tailgating is male, so they hold the door open for who?
The women behind
it. Women. So your partner on the team, it has to be a woman because you're going to then hold the door open for her. You don't want it to look like three people are tailgating coming in through the door. So one does the tailgate and the other's polite.
So let me come back and I'll direct this one to you, Paul, but I'm sure Anton may have some thoughts on it as well. So if we can develop one of these highly secure systems that essentially the vendor themselves can't break, should it be legal to do that, do you think?
Well, again, personal freedom, and you know, I think as Anton said, you really can't stop the technology. You know, you can't. If something is possible, you know, people will do it. And then, I suppose, then there's the principle of do no harm. The question is, are you doing harm? I think that would be a criteria, I think. But, and I think if it were used for evil purposes, we'd probably try to stop that. But if it's not, you know, it's just inane, people will do it.
Okay. There is currently legislation being proposed in the U.S. Senate that basically suggests that it should be required of all U.S. manufacturers of hardware and software that they produce security that they are able to break.
Themselves.
With a proper court order. Which presumably means that they do have to ensure that they have the ability to break it.
Or to break into their own system, so to speak.
Right, to break in. So Apple, in this case, would have to be able to get into that system by some means that may only be known to them. And I believe the way that the legislation is being proposed is it would only be that they would never disclose necessarily to somebody else how they did it.
Yeah. So that would protect sort of their rights, so to speak. But then the other issue is, how do you enforce that?
It relies on the lowest paid employee at Apple, right? That's at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. That's scary. I think what that would do would drive U.S. technology companies overseas is what it would do. I don't know of any. There's very few technology companies that solely do business in the United States. If the U.S. made such a law, those products wouldn't be sold in any other country anymore. No country would want to buy it, knowing that there's a hole built into it. It would drive away all of our technology.
That actually sort of begs a very interesting issue internationally, which is, would other countries prefer to have a hole or prefer not to have a hole?
Depends on the country. I've lived in several. I spent 21 straight years overseas, and it depends on the country.
Do you know any that would actually prefer a solid encryption system that nobody could, including themselves, could break?
Nobody could break?
Right.
Israel.
Israel would go
first
for one.
One that comes to mind. Most of Western Europe, except France, Belgium's probably on the fence, maybe Holland. The rest would probably, Germany for sure, they're very privacy oriented. The rest would probably, they'd be okay if they could get into it, but nobody else. But that's not, again, that's like our opening up the Apple device problem. It's not going to happen.
Well,
if somebody can get into it, everybody can get into it, and that's going to be the problem.
But it's highly pertinent to your other observation, which is, if the U.S. mandates something, then U.S. manufacturers or whomever might go to a different country build the highly secure environment. Yeah. And what you're suggesting is, there are countries that would accept that and be willing to provide those people a home without putting another mandate on them to make it open to them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think there are. I think there are. A lot of the I'll say, Western-leaning countries, but also some of the Asian countries would be very open to that, to bringing that technology in. They're looking for things like that.
Okay.
Security is a growing field. There's, from the business perspective, as a security business person, it's an extremely lucrative market for the right niches. Getting people to care about security is one hurdle. But there are certain areas where people really care about it, especially when massive breaches occur and Snowden leaks come out and things like that. That business is extremely, there's a lot of money to be made there. And I think the countries are very well aware of that. Remember, they're not just bringing in a manufacturer of a piece of software that can do something that you can't break into. They're bringing the jobs with that. And what kind of jobs are those? Those are STEM jobs. Those are really high-end jobs. Those are good jobs. Those are stable people.
Okay.
Families. I mean, you're bringing in good things to your country. So yeah, I think they'd be very willing to do that.
So I think you may have answered a question I also had, which is basically, does that create a competitive advantage for some foreign country in terms of their ability to build technology and sell it? And I think I just heard you say yes to that.
Yeah, I would say yes, definitely. Why do we turn to Israel, right? It's not official, but it appears that an Israeli company is the one that got into the iPhone, yeah. And that to me, as somebody who's been to Israel for security purposes on occasions for Western technology companies a lot, it that makes sense. There's a ton of pretty good security companies in Israel.
Okay. Just to finish off this thing, because I think we'll lead somewhere else from here, but it seems to me that bad guys might have a high incentive to either create their own tools or to acquire ones from third parties that are, in fact, basically unbreakable as much as law enforcement agencies would like to break them. Is that a likely scenario?
I don't really have a comment. I would say it should be possible.
Yeah, ISIS has a whole suite of software that they've rolled out for their mobile devices and their laptops that they're using right now that encrypts their chat communications, encrypts their emails, sets up aliases, does onion routing, does all the good security things. They have entire suites of software. They distribute these software package suites to their terrorist buddies that do all this stuff. So
just as a point, we probably won't have a pointer to ISIS on our website,
right,
in case people are trying to locate that software.
Thing, yeah. We don't want to download those packages. They may be
They might be very good. On the other hand, they might also have another
pretty
ear
much guarantee
attached to
the
them.
FBI is going
to
come visit you.
Could be. So back to our citizens, public here in Bedford or other parts of the country, who are the bad guys? Do our law-abiding citizens actually need to worry about their privacy and security? If you're not breaking the law, is it really an issue?
Well, I think, you know, we want to protect our Social Security numbers and financial data. We don't want people stealing. We don't want people stealing our identity. And I think a general approach is, you brought up the whole, you might say, that you maybe describe this better than I, Jim, but basically the people that will, the blackmail. Want to talk about blackmail, for example? Describe that to people.
Yeah, I think the concept there is that people break into your computer and they can encrypt the entire contents of your computer, and then they send you a note saying if you would like to get access to your data again, you have to pay us X dollars. Now, if they do it for a personal computer,
Bitcoins. They don't take dollars. Dollars are traceable.
Right. Bitcoins. So they take Bitcoins, which are not traceable. Good point. So they charge, I don't know what it would be, $50 equivalent in Bitcoins if you want to undo a personal computer. But they also go after police departments and they go after hospitals. And needless to say, they ask for more money from people who have more vested interest in the content of their computers.
And as of late, they've been acting like they're doing it in the UK and tricking people into sending them payments, even though they hadn't encrypted everything on their hard drives yet. So there's even the fakers out there, if you will.
So almost that's another social engineering example,
It is. They're too lazy to code it themselves. And so they're riding on...
Send us the
idea
money.
That somebody thinks they can't use their computer anymore, and they pay them anyway. So
if this happens to you, what do? Do you go to your police department or the FBI? Or?
Well, you have to report it, or you should report it.
What do you report it to?
The police.
Yeah.
And it's not as painful as identity theft. That's really painful with the police. But depending on the version of software that was used, the hostile software to encrypt your hard drive, it might be able to be decrypted by experts.
I see.
I mean, honestly, I'm not sure that the police would even know at that time if it's decryptable or not, because it's constantly changing. Security companies, antivirus companies, there's some of them that specialize in this, and they really dislike these people. They're selling products and they're doing things, but they really dislike them as well. So when they encrypt these hard drives, they'll make as soon as they figure out how to decrypt it, they'll make it available for free, usually just on their website. They'll have instructions how to go ahead and decrypt it and get it off there. But again, it's a rolling target. So
I think the answer, though, is start with your local police. So you report your situation to them. They will have some level of knowledge. I know, for example, the Bedford Police Department has a fairly high knowledge of technology. It's maybe uncommon. And there's the gotcha there. Maybe if there's not an easy known solution to the problem, it may cost more money to actually get the problem resolved with third parties than it would just to pay the ransom.
Yeah.
So that's part of the game that's being played.
Yeah, for an individual, almost certainly it would cost more to have a professional try to deal with it than it would
to pay
the ransom. The individual ransoms are usually low in the, like a Bitcoin's, what is it? It's like $600 or something, I think, something like that. So it's not, I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's, you're going to pay more than that to have an expert come in because it's going to take them a couple of days, right? And they're not cheap.
But how about...
Prepare yourself, Paul.
Well, isn't the best defense, though, to have your data, back it up on a hard drive, which is separate from your computer, and you hide it somewhere in your house. They're trying to charge you for your data, but the data that really counts isn't affected. So you probably just reboot your computer and use your data off your hard drive, and you don't have to pay the ransom. Isn't that a better solution?
I mean, regular backups are a real good thing to do anyway.
Right.
Regular backups, and then take them offline. Don't keep them online.
That's right.
If they're connected to your computer and the computer sees that as a remote drive, when the malicious software comes in, it may encrypt all those network drives as well.
It will. That's right.
The hospitals that were recently hit for ransom, that's what happened. It just started encrypting everything. They didn't have disks, like when you go to the doctor and they're doing the typing, most of the data is actually sitting somewhere else on, you know, data storage. They encrypted all that. So it wasn't available. You don't want that to happen.
That's
to your
right.
Backup.
It should be disconnected from your network. Right. That's right. Right. It should be. Then it won't be.
And then keep your antivirus software up to date. I mean, we say it over and over, but I don't know how the studio here is, but it's a common problem. And antivirus software, in my opinion, isn't enough. I always recommend some type of malware, specific malware software, anti-malware software on there. There's some that are free. Malware Bytes is a real good free version. I ended up buying the commercial version, the pay-for version, and covered everything in the house because I just got too paranoid about it. I get sent, as a security person, I get sent a lot of malicious software. a lot. I get targeted. I get constant. It's my wife really appreciates it. So I have to be very careful, right? I can't click on anything. When I surf the net, everything is dead in the links on my computers. Everything is dead. Video doesn't even show. There's no picture, nothing. When I go to a news site, it's completely dead content. It's a little bit overkill, but my risk level is higher.
I just point out that on our website, we will also have pointers off to the FBI site that has recommendations for types of software.
Right.
AARP has some, and there's one other source, I think, or two other sources we'll have on there that also have links to things like Malwarebytes and some of the free virus
right,
software
right.
and so forth.
And the other thing is keeping your software updated. So, you know, antivirus, anti-malware software, keep your updates, not just your operating system. You've got your web browser. Firefox sent an out-of-band patch today that required a restart. I don't know why, so there was something really nasty that they forced out today, midday. My software, you can configure them normally. I have my systems checking at least four times in a 24-hour period. They constantly check. With today's computers, it doesn't matter. It can constantly be checking. As you want the update as soon as it's there, because right now, as soon as a hole is announced in software, the bad guys already have something out there. They're already poisoning news websites and everything else. So you go surf to that, and you automatically download that into your system, and it affects you. There was recently several news websites, and GoDaddy and several news websites were actually poisoned. Somebody loaded malicious stuff up there so that this malicious software downloaded on anybody that surfed to the site.
So just accessing the website,
just looking at it,
was sufficient to cause something to be brought
exactly.
into your machine.
Yeah, the content is active, so it's doing things and using your system to do that. It's using your memory. Don't believe me? Turn off JavaScript and go to whatever news site you want to and see see if it even works. It won't even load. So
this also implies that you probably should be turning your computer off regularly. And the reason I say that is a lot of the updates, at least that Microsoft sends out, only initiate when you power down your computer. It could now install the updates and boot your machine back up.
It depends on how you configure it. So you can configure your computer now to download and update itself automatically, in which case, if it's on right now, and we're here at the studio, if your computer's on at home, it'll download the update if there's one there, and it'll do whatever it needs to do if you've configured it to do that way. One of the other options is to download the updates, I believe, and notify you, and we're talking Microsoft here. Download the updates and notify you, and then you have to okay the reboot. And then even if it does it automatically, it's going to give you a warning. It's going to say, this is going to be rebooting in 2 minutes or whatever as you frantically try to save your Word document. And then the other one is don't even check for updates. So and different software has different settings. So Flash, which is probably one of the most buggy, dangerous software pieces that you can have on your computer, but you probably need to see a lot of stuff. It's horrible. That you want updating on its own as fast as it can, because it's just horrible. It provides such a risk to your computer. And a lot of websites are moving away from Flash as a result of that.
So to summarize, I think from the standpoint of the public's perspective, when you see those messages that say, you know, we need to reboot your computer to install updates, you probably do want to do that, and B, it may be frustrating with the time it takes to install and configure them, as I have noticed myself, but you do want to make sure that happens fairly quickly.
You do. And Apple, for those Apple users, Apple has a similar system. You can configure the updates in it. I know my wife has a MacBook Pro, and it does its thing on its own.
Okay. So now let me come back to something. We've done a very useful job, I think, touching on some of the things you can do to protect yourself. Go ahead.
I'm going to interrupt you, Jim.
Go ahead.
Don't forget about your cell phone, people. Yesterday, people out there, yesterday there was some extremely critical Android patches for those of you that are Android users. And those are usually a nightmare for us Android users because we have to wait on our cell phone provider to issue the patch. AT&T managed it about 2 p.m. yesterday. They pushed out a patch, which was really fast. I just got notified of it and it came out. So that was really good, but that tells me it was really bad as well.
So, you mean a serious problem for the
user?
Yeah,
a very serious problem and the kind of problem that requires you to restart your phone completely. So it's like a 300 meg download and then it's like a 20-minute process you're going to be without your phone. But if you see those, do them. If not, go to your settings, go all the way down to the bottom to I think it's about and then check for updates. You should be having your phone configured to check for updates regularly. They're nothing more than smaller computers or tablets. All those devices you need to have updating whenever the updates come. The hackers and evil people are working really fast, and there's a lot of updates for these devices, and you don't want to miss them. If you miss them, it may be a matter of 24 hours, and now they're in your device. So if you're doing mobile banking like I do, they're in your device. They're watching your mobile banking, right? You're talking with your kids and sending data back and forth. They're in that, right?
Once more, let me back off and make something clear to people that may not be obvious. I think those of us who have been around the industry a while realize it. The only reason you get an update or a security improvement or an antivirus company discovers a virus and is prepared to actually deal with it is because the bad guys have been doing something already for some period of time. So what they call day zero on an attack occurs when the bad guys start doing it.
Yeah.
It takes a while after that before the good guys find out that it's even being done. And then it takes a while after that before they figure out what to do to stop it.
Yeah, either that or security researchers found a hole that was glaring and also really bad. And they need the manufacturer to fix it. And the manufacturer is kind of waffling and doesn't want to invest the resources in fixing it. So the researchers will say, okay, you have 90 days. And we're going to go ahead and tell the U.S. CERT, which is a collector of bugs. It's a website you can go to and see what holes are in software. They'll say, we're going to go ahead and report it to them, to the government, and they'll post it, and then you have to patch it. So they normally notify the vendors, and I've done this before, we found bugs, notify the vendor, Cisco or whoever, HP, and tell them, you've got a real problem with your software. This is where it is. This is what we found. They say, okay. And you say, I'll give you 90 days. And they say, well, actually, we need maybe 120 days. Okay. Most researchers are fine with that as long as they're working on it and they're going to have a patch out. But if they don't do that, the industry historically, that action resulted out of inaction by the software companies. They weren't patching the software. And so security researchers took to kind of putting them on notice that we're going to let the public know if you don't patch it. And so they had to patch it. It's money. It's a business case, right? It comes down to money. Do they invest, you know, three of their best coders 6 weeks to fix it?
What I think I heard you just describe is essentially the role that a white hat type operation does.
Yes.
They check security operations, they try to find problems, and they report them to the people who can fix the problems.
Yes.
As opposed to the black hat guys, the bad guys, who look for problems when they find them. They might sell them to their friends, but they're certainly not going to tell the people who can fix them because everybody in that community wants to exploit them.
Exactly. And I a few years back in Europe, I ran into a problem where we were on a job for a large communications provider. And we found we were doing a security assessment for this phone company, basically. And we found some bugs in some extremely well-known company's equipment. And it was used around the globe. And so the company that hired us was very concerned. They notified the vendor. The vendor issued them an operating system patch for that device, and only them. They left the rest of the planet vulnerable.
Hmm.
So after about 6 months, our customer, we were still working for them, they called us up and they said, is there something we can do here because this isn't right? Well, we can let them know that we're going to release it. But, you know, you're the customer. We were under NDA and everything. They said, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And so we actually forced the vendor, very well-known vendor, into issuing a patch globally, but they had actually only patched a special version for the devices on this customer's network and left everybody else wide open. Mm-hmm. And it was sad actually, because they could do it. They did it.
Yeah. So I have a couple other examples that you may want to take a look at. If I have one of these new cars that has the facilities built into it to communicate with the internet, you know, I can do Wi-Fi from my car. It might be connected to my cell phone. It might be talking to a service that would provide response if there's an accident. It might be talking to my insurance company to convince them that I'm not driving too fast. Is that a problem?
I'll say this. When I rent a car, I never give that Bluetooth connection access to the contacts on my phone. Never. There's no reason a phone needs to have the data sucked off it by the car you're driving for the weekend or something. Security is poor in most, I think it's fair to say security is poor in most wired vehicles, if you will, at present. They're working on it. Some are working on it. But as we've seen with the Dodge Chrysler nightmare they had with their systems, the security researchers walked through them. They could turn the car off. They could hit the brakes. They could do all kinds of things with the cars. Aircraft, as we've seen recently, are the same way. Some of the aircraft systems are tied into other systems that passengers could conceivably access, or maybe they weren't supposed to, but you know, a 10-year-old could do it and jump the networks and then get into control system type areas where they shouldn't be mucking about and do things to the plane. We've seen that security, as in most other areas, has not been the first concern when these things were designed. I think cars, unfortunately, we had a chance to do better, and they're getting better. But right now, there's still a lot of patching going on, and that's just the first round. We have to remember, this is just the first round. We've just had these smart cars come out, and then the security researchers just ripped them apart, and there was nothing. There's no segregation. There's no privilege. There's privilege issues across the way the systems are designed, and so I think we need to maybe go slower. It's all market driven, so you know, whoever is first to market. So, security is not a big concern.
Yeah, I'd just point out to people, and I'll again put up a pointer on the website that 60 Minutes had a segment where they demonstrated how DARPA broke into a car, and was able to disable the brakes while the car was being driven.
I think that's the stuff that was at Black Hat.
Black Hat had another example of another car broken into, I think, by independent people from DARPA. It wasn't even the DARPA break-in.
Yeah, no, it wasn't DARPA guys. Yeah. I mean, we had messed with a group I was with, some people I worked with a few years ago in Europe at one time, before wired cars, if you will, but when cars communicate, like in Europe, they communicate with a traffic warning system, like they're trying to do here in the U.S., just about every overpass in Europe has a device on it that measures traffic flow. Those feed to a system, so if a backup occurs, it goes out over the radio, and you've got an RDS, Romeo Delta Sierra, button on your car radio. Everybody has them in Europe. If you push that, you'll get alerts, even if you're listening to a CD. So it'll interrupt your CD, it'll pause it, and it'll say, "There's traffic is slow between exit 23 and 24," or something like that. It may even tell you, take exit 22 to go around, and there will be a detour. It does that automatically. So that told us the car's taking a feed from an external system. So, of course, as a security researcher, you want to know how secure that feed is. It also married that up with an operating system in the trunk of some cars that have the navigation system. So it's got the whole navigation system. So we played around with that and did things like tell the car it's out of gas when it's not. And really high-end expensive cars will shut themselves off before they run out of gas. So we'd tell it's out of gas and it just shut down. So that was pretty fun.
Now, let me just, for the listeners, take this one step further, because I had this discussion with an insurance company about adding a device to my car that would use my cell phone to talk to, or maybe even an internally built cell phone, it wasn't even mine, to talk to the insurance company to help them know that I was obeying the laws. Anton is over there shaking his head negatively. And I basically got back to my insurance company and said, let me give you a couple of scenarios. your CEO as an insurance company has received a threat saying that if he doesn't pay $1 million, bitcoins, to some outfit,
right,
that some of their cars are all of a sudden going to start going off the road at high speed, taken over by somebody using the DARPA-type attack on the car, right, disabling the brakes on freeways and taking their cars off the road. Is your CEO going to pay the Bitcoin amount, or are they confident enough in their software that they're willing to take the publicity hit if cars start going off the road?
So did they answer or just hang up?
Oh, they gave me an assurance that their software was good. And I...
We'll have to talk about that after this radio program.
Yeah, well, yes. There is a long discussion to take place. Unfortunately, they may not recognize the problem until they get the threat slash, or until cars start going off the road. Unfortunately, most cyber attacks are not ones that lead to what I would call blood on the front page. So terrorists who have a desire to create front page issues with blood all over the front page don't usually use cyber attacks as a method to accomplish their objectives. However, this is an example that would be subject to terrorism. You can imagine a large number of cars going off the road somewhere in the world and a terrorist organization taking credit for that. That would be terror.
But I mean, that's one that may not affect our residents right here. But one that could, and probably already has, is that CEO of the company or that CTO of the company down in the mill yard, the high-tech company, that foreign government hackers have already gotten into his home network. Not his company, because the security is too good there. They've gotten into his home network, into his PC via his home network, so that they can jump into his corporate network and steal company secrets and take away patented ideas and technology that his company and his employees have developed, people here locally, and stolen it and then duplicated it elsewhere offshore. And that, unfortunately, that industrial espionage is real and happens every day around the world.
And importantly, you don't know what's happened to you.
Right.
Until you see that product out there that just happens to be using the exact same circuit designs you developed.
Right, right. And depending on what they're stealing, whether it's technology or whatever, like in the case of apparently the Chinese breaking into the U.S. government's networks and stealing all their security interviews for security clearances and all that data, that's all data that can be used to blackmail all those people, or a lot of it is. I've held high-level security clearances, and some of the stuff that's in there is quite significant, and maybe somebody doesn't want out in the public. And that's all stuff that can be used to blackmail people. And you need to think about that. It's not just, well, I'm sitting here in Bedford and I'm not a target. Well, maybe it's your kids. Maybe it's your children that are the target. Maybe somebody's looking for children. There's bad people everywhere. So you need to protect yourself with basic mechanisms so that you don't become a target for one of those off-the-wall type attacks, whether it's, you know, the company you work for being attacked, the company you're doing marketing for, right? I mean, that's another one. There's a lot of marketing companies in the United States. That's great. If I want to find out, and if I want to make some money on stocks, right, a little insider trading, I'm going to go to the marketing agency. That company that's getting ready to release something surely has had their marketing agency working overtime quietly to queue up that news release so that they can tell the world what they did. If you can break in and get that release a day or two earlier and make a couple trades, right? So
we've actually identified a number of motives for actually breaking into people's systems, even here in Bedford.
Yeah.
Okay, let me do one last technical question, which is, what recommendations do people have about passwords? It seems every place I go today, I have to have a password. My electric company wants me to have a password so that I can pay my bill. And I'm a little paranoid about other people paying my bill for me, but...
So the first thing I'll say with passwords is don't use a fingerprint, like for your phone and things like that. A fingerprint, from a legal perspective, a fingerprint is a lot different. Most people don't realize this, is a lot different than a PIN code that you're going to enter, like in your phone. Like you see my phone here. It has a fingerprint scanner. I don't use that because I can be legally forced to give up my fingerprint. They don't even need a search warrant to get my fingerprint. Law enforcement can take my fingerprint. From a legal perspective, getting access to your PIN to have you open that is a little bit different. It's more like self-incrimination. And I'm not a legal guy, and I'm not an expert, but I know for a fact there's a very big difference between using a PIN and using a fingerprint. And most legal scholars, including some at Stanford, will tell you you don't want to use a fingerprint. You want to use a...
So to clarify, the reason for not using the fingerprint is not because it's insecure. It's because it's already available potentially to people who would not need a warrant as a result.
It is, or yeah. It can be gotten to without. There was a woman recently in the past 2 weeks that was forced by a court to give up her fingerprint to open her phone. Whereas if she had have used a PIN, it's a lot harder bar to reach.
Okay.
To force somebody to give up a PIN code. And there's the lawyers listening, I'm sure, know why. But I'm not real sure the legal reason why. But there's a big difference. I know that. The other thing is, don't double up characters. So if you're using a password, don't use two of the same characters in a row.
Ah.
Don't use any real words, period.
Because of dictionaries.
Yeah, dictionary attacks. Normally when we go and do security assessments at a company, we may use 14 or 15 different foreign language dictionaries when we're trying to crack all the passwords, and we'll run through those overnight. So if you're using a word and you're thinking because you're using it in Vietnamese, we won't find it, we will. So that's one thing. The other thing is think of a phrase. I have some passwords I use right now that are 26 or more characters, and I never forget them. There's no way I'd forget them because they're funny little phrases or rhymes or riddles, and I transpose characters. Like instead of an I, I can use for an I, I can use a capital I or a lowercase I, or a 1. For an S, I can use a capital S, a lowercase S, or a 5. A 3 for an E. So I try to transpose characters, and you figure out a way that's easy for you and use them. The other thing is I try to use different passwords for, I'll say, high-risk things like banking than the electric company. Because if normally when we crack passwords, it's easy to say use a different password for everything, but people aren't going to remember the 25 or 30 passwords they need to remember today. So try to break them up into two or three groups by risk level, right? And then keep those to yourself or between yourself and your spouse. We talked about the phones earlier. My spouse knows how to get into my phone. The police, it'd be difficult for them with some of the stuff I have on here, but they could probably get in over time, but my wife can get into it instantly.
Yeah, and I just point out to people, one of the issues that arises is what happens if you're disabled and you're no longer able to get to your device, and it may be important for your family to be able to get access. So you do want to have a level of sharing information. I'll give you an example that I saw in a computer magazine from IEEE a couple of years ago now of a password along the way you described, which was to take the phrase 47 years ago, which is easy to remember, and now present it in a different form, which is to use the number 4, use the word score, use an ampersand for and, use 7 spelled out or 7 as a digit, then annos, use the translation of the word years into a different language as a password. It is a combination of characters, uppercase, lowercase, and so forth. And by the way, don't use that example because that one's already on the internet. And people use anything they can find on the internet as another way of searching and breaking passwords.